From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Abuse of pain medication is of epidemic proportions. Americans of all stripes turning to prescription pain pills for legitimate relief and slowly finding themselves trapped in a cycle of dependence. Last week, the FDA announced a new plan to change the way doctors prescribe addictive pain medications. It's complicated. This hour On Point, unpacking the FDA's new approach to powerful pain meds. You can join us on air or online should anyone get 60 pain pills for wisdom teeth. But what about for cancer treatment? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York City is Barry Meyer, health policy and business reporter for The New York Times. He wrote a big story in The Times this Sunday detailing the FDA's recommendations. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. He is also author of A World of Hurt, Fixing Pain Medicine's Biggest Mistake. Barry, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So tell us exactly what the FDA is recommending.
So the big picture issue is this. There is a widely used class of painkillers that contain the narcotic hydrocodone and an over-the-counter medication like acetaminophen or Tylenol. This is the most widely used class of painkillers in the United States. They account for about 70% of all the narcotic painkillers prescribed. Traditionally, these drugs have been classified as so-called Schedule III drugs and kind of less restrictive prescribing rules related to them. They were subsequently recommended by the FDA last week, to go up to Schedule II. In the real world, that means that doctors will only be able to prescribe 90-day supplies versus 100-day supplies, and patients will have to bring these prescriptions in by hand rather than having doctors call them in.
Are those the only is that the only difference that patients will notice, practically speaking, if these recommendations are put into effect?
There may be some others. In some states, folks like physician's assistants, nurse practitioners can prescribe Schedule III drugs, like these drugs, which are known as Vicodin or Lortab, but they can't prescribe Schedule II drugs. So unless those state law changes occur, these groups of health professionals won't be able to prescribe these drugs.
So you mentioned a couple of the drugs, Vicodin and Lortab. What are some of the other ones that we're talking about here?
Well, this is basically they're all the same drug. They're all a mixture of hydrocodone and acetaminophen. Vicodin and Lortab, those were how the drugs were originally marketed 50 years ago. They were the brand names. Now they're widely marketed as generic. So, I don't know, 95% of these drugs will come to you as hydrocodone plus acetaminophen. They won't say Lortab or Vicodin on it.
So were these FDA recommendations unexpected? Have they been considered before? I mean, why now?
That's a very good question. This all traces back to about 1999 when a drug addiction specialist up in Syracuse started seeing a lot of patients coming into his practice addicted to these drugs as opposed to heroin or street drugs. He petitioned the Drug Enforcement Administration, which sets these prescribing categories, to upschedule or tighten prescribing restrictions on these drugs. So this debate's been kicking around for over a decade, but it was during this past decade where you've seen both a boom in the prescribing of these drugs as well as a boom in the public health problems such as addiction and abuse. And I think while the FDA scientists themselves said that from their perspective, nothing had changed with respect to the scientific criteria as to whether these drugs should be Schedule III or Schedule II, I think there was a lot of political pressure. There was a lot of pressure from public health advocates to tighten down the regulations.
Well, as you say, political pressure. I mean, Congress has dealt with this issue before. In June 2012, Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat of West Virginia, pushed unsuccessfully to put tighter controls on these powerful pain drugs. Here he is speaking on the Senate floor after his measure failed.
High-powered and well-funded lobbyists may have gotten their victory this time around, but I can assure you I will not give up this fight, as I know many of my colleagues won't either. I am hearing on a daily basis from my constituents in West Virginia and all around this country who are counting on us, their elected representatives, to do something about the prescription drug epidemic ravaging their communities.
And here's Representative Fred Upton, Republican of Michigan, the largest recipient of drug industry campaign contributions in the 2012 cycle, speaking in support of the stripped-down painkiller bill.
The process of approving not only medical devices but prescription drugs would only be lengthier, more costly, and obviously an impact on patients as well as industry folks as well.
So, Barry Meyer of the New York Times, help us understand the epidemic of prescription drug abuse in this country. What are the numbers and who is abusing these drugs?
Well, about 17,000 people a year have been dying in drug overdoses involving prescription opioids or narcotics. And that number has grown over the past decade. It's tripled or quadrupled as the volume of these drugs they're prescribing has tripled and quadrupled as well. I mean, essentially, from a big picture perspective, we've moved to the treatment of pain pharmacologically. We're treating pain, long-term pain, with these drugs. And, you know, one of the issues that kind of overarches this debate is that really the best way to treat pain? Should we be using other methods to treat pain? And have we become over-reliant on as a society on the use of these very powerful and also very complicated, complex drugs to treat pain?
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Josiah Rich, a professor at Brown University School of Medicine, an expert in addiction. Dr. Rich, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here, Jane.
So tell me, what is your view of the FDA recommendations to reclassify these powerful painkiller drugs, essentially to make them harder to prescribe and harder to abuse?
Jane, the problem here, the disease that we are that we're addressing here, is the disease of opiate addiction, and in this country we've had a bit of a pendulum swing around the treatment of pain using opiates. Many decades ago, we were undertreating pain, including people dying of cancer, and that was a shameful chapter in our history. And the pendulum has swung the other way. We have a culture of using opiates, using short and long-term opiates to treat pain.
So then how do you draw the line, doctor, between legitimate pain and medical addiction?
So we don't have a simple test where we can say if somebody has pain or not. If somebody says they have pain, you have to take that at face value. So it's not like many other diseases where we can do a test and we can find out exactly what they have. And I think I don't really know what legitimate pain is. But I do know that with this switch towards using more opiates, we have gotten ourselves into a lot of trouble with opiate addiction and then subsequent overdose deaths.
So I hear you saying you agree with the FDA recommendations to pull back a little bit and make it harder to prescribe?
I think this is a step in the right direction in terms of changing the culture of physicians prescribing pain and changing the culture of society wanting a pill to make things go away.
Do you see any risks for patients if the FDA regulates these painkillers differently?
Sure. Well, I think the main reason to not do this is that it's very convenient for both patients and physicians. On nights and weekends, when I get a call as a physician that a patient has pain, I can call a pharmacy and say, give this patient pain medicines. I believe that will no longer be a possibility. That is going to mean some patients are going to have more discomfort at home and maybe go to emergency rooms.
Barry Meyer, tell us about the tremendous lobbying efforts by patient groups, by drug manufacturers, drug stores, all arguing that patients will be adversely affected. What's their reasoning?
Well, the reasoning is somewhat along the lines that Dr. Rich mentioned, and they also argue that, you know, you're inconveniencing all these patients because there are some bad actors out there. A big part of the problem, however, is that over this past decade, this problem of excess capacity and abuse of these drugs has been in some ways created by unthinking and even unethical drug companies and drug stores who've been doling this stuff out or shipping it to parts of the country where they know extensive abuse was going on. So, you know, this problem was created by a lot of players in our societies. It's not just the, you know, the drug abusers that are out there. So, you know, it's kind of hard to separate their arguments from, you know, their compassion for patients from their profits in this situation. There are clearly patients that are going to be inconvenienced by this. There are clearly patients that are going to face new hardships because of this. The size of that population, as far as the experts that I've spoken to, really isn't known. It's sort of speculative because most patients use these drugs for very short periods of time.
Mm-hmm. And so what's the timetable here, Barry, for an FDA proposal like this to be implemented?
First, it's got to be seconded by the Department of Health and Human Services, and then it goes from there over to the Drug Enforcement Administration, which adopts it. And I think all the pieces of the government bureaucracy are kind of teed up for that to happen. So this is likely to kick in the earlier part of next year.
Dr. Rich, did these recommendations surprise you? Did it sort of come out of the blue for you and other physicians?
No. We've been sort of thinking about this, anticipating it. I would just say that, you know, on the flip side, yes, there's certainly some patients are going to have more pain and more inconvenience, and as same with doctors, inconvenience. But on the flip side, we have this epidemic of opiate addiction, which we've essentially flooded the market with a lot of opiates. And some people, when exposed to opiates, are going to get into real trouble.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. The FDA announced plans to change the way doctors, dentists, and healthcare professionals prescribe high-strength pain meds like OxyContin and Vicodin. Here's some sound from former NFL quarterback Ray Lucas speaking to CBS in August of 2012 about his painful addiction to painkillers.
When you get to a certain point where you're taking 800 pills, you're not so much taking it for the pain anymore. Your body needs it to function. And you wake up with the thought of pills on your mind, you go to sleep with pills on your mind, and you will sell yourself to the devil to make sure that you have them.
A lot of listener feedback this hour online. Let's go to the phones first here. Kevin is in Randolph, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'm pretty sure that if some enterprising young party boy figured out a way to get high with Parkinson's drugs or insulin or chemo drugs, people wouldn't be bending over backwards to try to make it more difficult for these drugs to be prescribed. But pain has always been given short shrift in the medical world. People, like some of your guests, want to try to tell me that I have alternatives and I can't rely on a pill, or I shouldn't rely on a pill, but I should rely on bushels of ibuprofen and bushels of aspirin and Tylenol that are ineffective, and wrapping ice and wrapping heat for hours on end, that's ineffective. But oxycodone or hydrocodone are bad things because they relieve my pain. And I've never understood this. We wouldn't do it with diabetics or Parkinson's patients. Why is pain
any different? Kevin, I hear your sentiment. Let's get another thought from Jeffrey in Worcester, Massachusetts. Jeffrey, hi. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to say that, you know, my wife suffers from severe chronic pain, and it's been almost impossible to find doctors willing to treat her because they're scared of the DEA coming in. And her last doctor, a guy named Miss Allie in Worcester here, there was a witch hunt started by some new pharmacies, the big chains, and they pulled his license. And what they did was they brought in one doctor who wrote everybody half scripts, and then they closed the place. So there's about 1,000 people here in Worcester who have lost their pain management. And it's not an inconvenience. I mean, if you have cancer, everybody feels sorry for you. But if you've got, my wife had broken her pelvis, broken her back, she's got severe avascular necrosis of the right TMJ. And she basically can't get out of bed without the proper pain management.
I hear it. Jeffrey, thank you very much for the call, for the perspective. We have a lot to get in this hour. I'm joined by Barry Meyer, health policy and business reporter for The New York Times, addiction expert Dr. Josiah Rich of Brown University School of Medicine. Let me now bring in another voice joining me from Houston, Texas, Dr. Brian Bruehl, assistant professor in the Department of Pain Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Doctor, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So what's your view, hearing these calls, hearing the conversation we've had so far, what's your view of the FDA recommendations?
So initially, I thought that it was a good a plan from the FDA. As a pain physician practicing in a cancer center and also specializing in catastrophic injury pain, I was very happy because it raises awareness to the problem of opioids in our country. I think it is probably overprescribed to the wrong patient and maybe even underprescribed to the right patient. I think it is one step to solve the big problem, but I think that we can't be very myopic on this because this alone will not solve the real problem of addiction in our country.
And so from your perspective, what will?
I think other programs that might be considered, including things that many states are already starting, including a prescription drug monitoring program, might help us identify patients trying to get these medications for non-medical use. Other programs such as the Mental Health Parity Act, where, you know, if a person has a mental health problem or addiction problem, it's very easy to get them the care that they need. I see these patients every day, and part of my job as a pain physician is to identify those that are at risk for abusing. And once I identify these patients, it's sometimes very difficult to get them the appropriate care. And so if it makes it easy, if there's programs out there that helps doctors provide the referral or appropriate care, it might be the best approach.
So, doctor, should different populations, I think I hear you say different populations should be considered differently when it comes to prescribing powerful pain meds and any FDA recommendations? I mean, someone who's got a wisdom teeth extraction should be treated differently than perhaps someone who has, you know, who's dealing with cancer.
Yeah, you know, I think that every person is different, and when you approach a person dealing with chronic debilitating pain greater than 3 months, that approach is probably different than the person who just had major surgery, and you know the time frame for them to recover from that surgery is short. I tend to see the patients that have chronic debilitating pain, and they just want to get on with their lives, and so. Many patients, many of my patients are compliant. Many of my patients have no history of addiction and no risk factors. We have tools now to identify these high-risk patients.
But can you spot, doctor? But doctor, can you spot someone who is addicted? And what do you do about it in that case?
Yeah. So you can spot someone. You can have sort of an idea using tools that we have. We have questionnaires that look at the risk of that patient to become addicted. And those patients are on what I call my short list. Those patients I monitor, and I'm very keen on monitoring their behaviors, because if I sense, or if my tools for identifying addiction is there and I find it, I will probably talk to my patient about it in detail and tell them that they need help, that maybe their pain is because of depression or anxiety, because pain, we know, is very multimodal.
Dr. Jody Rich, jump back in here, professor of Brown University School of Medicine. Talk to us about the science of addiction. I was interested to learn that common painkillers have some of the same active ingredients as many street drugs and trigger the brain in the same way as well. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think from a simplistic standpoint, this medication, Vicodin, Lortab, hydrocodone, is an opiate. And opiates bind on the opiate receptor. There are subtle differences between opiate receptors and between the different opiates, but it's basically opiate addiction is what we're talking about. Now, some people are genetically prone to get addiction. Some people fall into certain circumstances, and some people have an exposure. So if you have the right circumstances, the right genetics, and you experiment with opiates, you are going to get into trouble. Now, other people are not going to get into trouble. I think we also need to distinguish between acute pain for when you have an acute injury and the chronic pain. You know, my heart goes out to Kevin and Jeffrey talking about the terrible chronic pain that their partners mm-hmm. are mm-hmm. suffering with. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that it's, you know, nobody's trying to say that pain should not be treated and not be treated with opiates. But at the same time, we are cutting back on opiates because we have such a problem with opiate addiction.
Barry Meyer, health policy and business reporter for The New York Times. What did the numbers show with regard to young people and abuse of prescription drugs? Not only young people, but women as well.
Well, the numbers are higher for women from a relative standpoint. And the reason experts believe that's happening is because they tend to report more problems related to long-term pain than men do, and so they get prescribed these drugs more often. I think that Dr. Buell and Dr. Richard, you know, both brought up points that really talk to the complexity of the situation, the complexities of treating pain, and also the other factor, which is within the group of long-term pain patients, people with chronic pain, the wives of the gentleman that called mm-hmm. in, what this regulation may do that could be beneficial is get these patients monitored more often so that we know that these treatments, using these drugs on them, are actually working in a way. They're not just treating their pain, but they're also improving their lives. They're improving their mobility. They're improving their social function. And for many patients who do take these drugs over long periods of time, those things don't improve. So the question is, do folks who are in that situation need these drugs and need other treatments as well?
Let's get back to the phones. Frank is in Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Frank. Thanks for waiting, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. A couple of points. One, from what I've heard, I think that, and what I've read, I think that a lot of the people who are supporting this kind of increasing restriction are oversimplifying the issue and focusing in on the opiate pain medications, and also ignoring perhaps unforeseen impacts. I know on NPR, and I can't, it might have been this show, it might have been another one, you just interviewed people who had done a study that indicated, for instance, that minorities, especially African Americans, are already under medicated for pain. One, because they're automatically suspected of drug seeking for illicit use, and also because of a dehumanizing attitude that blacks don't experience pain like whites do. Other complications I see are that people who are experiencing chronic pain, if they don't have access to these pain medications, will compensate, and I speak from personal experience, mm-hmm. by taking inappropriately large doses of over-the-counter pain medications like ibuprofen mm-hmm. and acetaminophen, which have long-term adverse health effects. Mm-hmm. And I would add to that list alcohol will compensate for pain with alcohol in combination.
And those can be toxic cocktails. Frank, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Brian Brewell, will you speak to Frank's issue? It's a complicated, complex issue.
Right. So with regards to Frank's issues, I think that he mentioned over-the-counter medications. We know the dangers of opioid medications with regards to addiction and potentially life-threatening complications with overdose, but we also need to know that the other alternatives for pain have the risks too, medication-wise, such as over-the-counter medications, such as your NSAIDs, your ibuprofens. They can cause toxicities that could be also potentially life-threatening. So sometimes when you look at risks versus benefits of certain treatments, and I have this discussion with my patients on a daily basis, I review the risk of a certain treatment, be it an opioid medication or an adjuvant medication, is what we call NSAIDs or anti-epileptics for pain. Mm-hmm. I talk about the side effects of these and the safety profile, and I talk about the benefits. And every time I trial a medicine, that's exactly what it is a trial. And if it doesn't work, then we might have to change direction. Mm-hmm. But I also discuss the risks. Mm. And some of the risks for opioids we've already discussed on this mm-hmm. Session. But I think we also have to discuss the risks for alternative therapies, and patients need have the right to know that because it's their life, it's their body that we're trying to improve.
Yeah, you talk about the alternative treatments, the risks. I mean, I continue to read that there are real questions within the medical community about the effectiveness of these opioids, and aren't there many substitutions now for opioids? I know that's very controversial, but aren't there substitutions that would minimize the need for such strong drugs, Dr. Burrell?
Yes, there are a lot of substitutions, but not everybody will respond to these substitutions. I think the best way to treat pain, and the way most of us who specialize in pain management and pain medicine believe that the best way to treat pain, and there's evidence behind it, is a multimodal approach. So, yes, opioids is one tool, but if it doesn't mm-hmm. work, if there's high risk for that patient to be on opioids, maybe that's not the right treatment for them.
Dr. Rich, jump in.
So I agree completely. We need to monitor the outcomes of pain treatment and the role of opiates in chronic pain. Now, I've heard the same story for my entire medical career with a slight variation. A couple decades ago, a patient came in and said, I'm addicted to opiates. They got addicted because they experimented with various drugs in their teenage years, in their 20s, and alcohol, and then eventually found heroin and became addicted. They developed tolerance, they developed withdrawal symptoms, and they had to use heroin 3 times a day, every day, 365. I hear the same story now, except now my patients are much younger. They're not in their late 20s and early 30s. These are teenagers and early 20-year-olds, and they say, you know, I got some Vicodins. I took it either because it was prescribed or because I found it in grandma's medicine cabinet, and I started liking the feeling. And then I started feeling better, and I started taking more. And then finally the doctor wised up and said, no, you're shut off. You don't need 3 months of Vicodin for a sprained ankle. And then I started getting it from my friends. And then I eventually found out that I had to steal and do other things to get the money to buy the pills. And then the pills finally got too expensive. So then I found out heroin is cheaper. So then I thought, okay, I'll use heroin. I started snorting it. I snorted it for a while. And then because people who are using opiates regularly develop tolerance, that means they have to use a higher and higher dose over time, I needed to use the heroin, which was cheaper. And then I went up on that dose until somebody said, well, if you inject it, you can get the same feeling with a lower dose. And then soon I was injecting a high dose, and then I was in real trouble.
Barry Meyer, New York Times, have you seen this in your reporting, this sort of trend that Dr. Rich is speaking of?
Well, certainly the, beginning with the aggressive marketing of OxyContin in the early 2000s, there was a tremendous upsurge in the use of these drugs by younger people, originally in Appalachia, rural places like Maine, and then spreading throughout the country, and they've become the most popular drug of abuse in this country. So it's a conundrum. I mean, it's the points that the doctors make, the points that your callers make. These are not easy decisions. These are decisions really where people are being hurt on either side of the equation, and they're very, very difficult, complicated situations to make.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, the FDA has announced proposed changes to the way medical professionals can prescribe powerful pain medications. The change comes after years of growing abuse, scandals, and concerns, and we're talking about that. I'm joined this hour, a terrific panel, Barry Meyer, health policy and business reporter for The New York Times, addiction expert Dr. Jody Rich of Brown University School of Medicine, and Dr. Brian Brouwell, assistant professor in the Department of Pain Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Let's go back to the phones. Melissa is in Garner, Iowa. Melissa, I'm glad you waited. Go ahead. Hello.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I grew up with a mother who was addicted to prescription medications, and I'm really quite relieved to hear about the new standards being placed.
And so what was the impact on your life, Melissa, from, as the daughter of an addict?
it was a lot of abuse in some degree, to some degree. I don't talk to my mother to this day. My sister is also sort of taking on that role of being addicted. She chooses some, she actually uses a lot of over-the-counter stuff as well to get her highs, but it's the same basic thing.
Did your mom start as a legitimate pain patient? She needed this medication, and then it turned into something worse?
I do think so. I do think she originally, I mean, she broke her neck. She broke the 6th and 7th vertebrae in her neck when I was actually probably about 3.
Mm-hmm.
But I think well after that, she didn't need them, but she still took them.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember waking up and, well, I just remember asking her questions when she was in bed, and she was just always in this drug and stupor, a lot of times just in bed. Mm-hmm. And the pills were there for us if we wanted them and all that other stuff. So it there does need to be more regulation.
Melissa, thank you. Dr. Rich, talk to us a little bit about the effect, the physiological, the biological effect of opiate addiction.
So when, you know, our football player said it very eloquently, your body needs it. And we're talking about a disease of the brain here. Now,
yes.
Our brains are hardwired for survival, the survival of the individual and survival of the species. In order to survive, we need to drink, we need to eat, we need to reproduce. So we have our cerebral cortex, the upper part of our brain, the more, you know, the evolutionary, more modern part of our brain, but we have the more primitive parts of the brain as well. So, for example, you can tell your brain to stop breathing. You tell your cerebral cortex can tell your body to start breathing. So you have control over your breathing, but only to a certain extent. After a minute, your primitive brain is going to take over and going to say, no, you can't hold your breath anymore. You have to breathe. Likewise with drinking, likewise with eating. That's really the part of the brain that's diseased with opiate addiction, that your body needs it. You will do whatever you can. And it's not a matter of thinking in your cerebral cortex. I would say that the vast majority of people addicted to opiates, if they could wave a wand and just get rid of being addicted to opiates, they would. They don't want to be tearing apart their families. They don't want to be abusing their children. They don't want to have their children become addicted. And sounds like Melissa's mom had, you know, a serious pain problem with a broken neck and took it and got into that. But unfortunately, her brain became diseased.
We have strong opinions on both sides of this from our listeners. From our Facebook page, Melanie says, I am not one to take a painkiller unless absolutely necessary. I believe they are overprescribed, and it is how some develop opiate addiction. Helen says, I think people in real pain are being punished for the misdeeds of a few. If someone wants something to abuse recreationally, they will find a way to get it. Making it harder for people who truly need it won't stop them. Here's another call from Linda in Odessa, Texas. Linda, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Danny. Hi. I wanted to call because I'm a pharmacist, and I see this from, well, I see it from several perspectives. I think that there are issues with some people being drug-seeking and doctor shopping. I think that the doctor from the pain clinic in Houston was pretty much right on in a lot of things. We do screen patients. We do look and make sure they're not seeing multiple doctors or seeing multiple pharmacies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we have to end up being the police. We have a corresponding liability with our licenses, and, you know, patients end up getting mad at us. I think that by making the restrictions even stricter, it is going to be punitive towards the patients.
Mm-hmm.
And it is going to be really hard towards us. I don't think it's going to really benefit people in the long run. I think it's going to end up, you know, when OxyContin break-ins were happening really
mm-hmm.
the hardcore in the pharmacy mm-hmm. a while back, I think that that's going to be something that's going to start again, because people who have legitimate pain needs need their pain meds. People
so, Linda, have you confronted patients?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what do you say?
Often. Well, it depends. If it's a fraudulent prescription, of course, then we're always, well, it depends. There's different policies, but mm-hmm. usually we won't feel anything like that. But when it's too soon, we have to tell them that. I personally like to tell patients that if they're having increased pain needs, they need to talk to their doctor, mm-hmm. that they need to get their pain medicines up. Mm-hmm. And then they you know, it's always a battle. We always say, well, you need to talk to your doctor about upping the pain meds. And they say, oh, well, I have. They told me I could take more if I need more. And I say, okay, good, but they need to tell us that.
Well, you are right. You are on the front lines. Linda, I appreciate your call as a pharmacist there. Here's Greg in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you, Jane. Mm-hmm. I'm a physician. I'm a chronic pain patient. Mm. And I have a son who's a recovered drug addict who used to steal my pain medicine. So I have a kind of a different perspective on it. First of all, and I have a question. You know, I was a medical director of a large medical group and constantly heard from my physicians that they never had any training in how to deal with and confront drug-seeking patients. So I wonder what can be done in terms of physician education, both in teaching them how, in fact, to confront drug-seeking patients. The second thing I'd like to say is that as a pediatrician, I saw pain control in kids with tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies move from Tylenol to hydrocodone with Tylenol. And when asked why they were using such powerful drugs in such young kids, the answer was so that they didn't get calls in the middle of the night from parents whose kids were in pain.
Yeah.
My son fortunately is recovered, and I see lots of his friends from NA and AA. And the comment made earlier about the expense of acquiring on the street hydrocodone or oxycodone or OxyContin is true. They all switch, or most of them switch, to heroin because these days, at least my personal experience is, because of the expense, and heroin is just cheaper.
Right, which is what Dr. Rich was saying. Let me take your call just for time's sake. I appreciate your calling in, Greg. Thank you very much. To Dr. Brian Brewell at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. What about that, Dr. Brewell, about doctor training, about helping our doctors sort of understand this issue more completely?
Right. So I absolutely agree with Greg. And I agree that something that we lack, even in the medical school training curriculum, is identifying the pain generator, a good physical exam, good history taking for pain itself. Musculoskeletal exam is lacking in medical school curriculums. Now, that's been identified and they're working on it. But when you have a physician that's not trained in pain medicine and primary care providers, they also need some training because maybe they didn't get it in medical school. He is on point about training with regards to, we have all these tools now, the doctor shopping law, the prescription drug monitoring programs, and tools to figure out who may be addicted to these medicines, and we're monitoring more as pain physicians. But even in my situation, sometimes my cancer patient may have an addiction problem, and it's very hard to discuss that with them in a face-to-face setting. So training about communication, being sensitive to their disease, because it's a disease, addiction is a disease, and getting them the help is important. And not just identifying, discussing with patients, and also something for physicians or programs for physicians to easily get that person the help that they need to Dr. Rich, maybe for addiction care.
Yeah.
That's important, and that's where there's continually barriers that I see in my practice.
Barry Meyer, New York Times reporter, jump in here because you've been writing a lot about the fact that the healthcare system, its current structure, is based on doctor's reimbursement model and the impact that that has on how a doctor dispenses pain medication. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, it has a tremendous impact. It has a tremendous impact in the way doctors treat pain, even more fundamentally. I was in a discussion the other day with a doctor who's a big wheel at the AMA, and he said that these drugs are actually suboptimal for many patients when it comes to treating pain. And my reaction to that was simply, why isn't the medical profession, other folks, lobbying for better pain treatments, for treatments that aren't based solely on these drugs, or for the care of people who can't take these drugs because they may have tendencies towards abuse and addiction? So, I mean, the issue here is you know, really we're talking about fiddling around the edges with these regulations, trying to tighten things down here and there. But the more fundamental question is, going forward, how are we going to treat what is a very prevalent health problem within our society? And shouldn't the people who pay for this treatment, being insurers, be paying for treatments that don't have the rampant public health consequences that this treatment has? Mm.
Let's go back to the phones. Emily is in Wilton, Iowa. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I am a family nurse practitioner. I have been for 16 years. I've done family practice the entire time. Let me say that including nurse practitioners and other clinicians who do primary care is a very important part and would really enlighten the discussion significantly. My concern is that in these discussions that have been increasingly public in the last year or so, maybe, the fact that all that the vast majority of these abused prescription drugs are exactly that, prescription. A licensed individual wrote those. We talk about monitoring with all the electronics we have available, the patients for who may have patterns of abuse, but we have ways to monitor physicians that are really prescribing inappropriately, and that is never done. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with physicians. It's quicker. They don't have the skills, frankly. Nursing has much better skills for the communication piece of this. I completely agree with the complexity of the issue.
Emily, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Dr. Rich, I'm curious, is the stigma of these kinds of pain-killing prescription drugs different from other kinds of drug addictions? And does that open the door for some people to step through?
We definitely need to open the door. I think there's probably less stigma around the prescribed opiates, and that may be part of the problem. But what we really have an opportunity here is to get people into treatment. When these monitoring programs identify an individual who has an opiate addiction, we have treatment that works very well. It was mentioned the Parity Act. That is not just for mental illness. That's for addiction treatment as well. With the medication treatments is fantastic. And in fact, we have a high prevalence now. So shutting down the supply is going to hopefully prevent more people from getting exposed. But the people that are already addicted, we need to get them into treatment.
Dr. Brian Brewell at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, how will these FDA recommendations on prescription drugs change how you view pain management with your patients?
I think it's from my standpoint as the prescribing physician, yes, there's going to be some roadblocks and barriers and probably more resource taken out of my clinic because, you know, we're going to have more calls from our patients and trying to schedule them in, regularly is probably going to be a more logistical problem. I think what my main concern is that this ruling may not be the best answer. It's a step, but I'm most concerned about what this ruling may cause for my patients, my good patients, my compliant patients, my patients who are functional, employed, enjoying retirement because they have adequate pain control. So my concern really is those patients calling in because they're all of a sudden undertreated. So I think it's a good step to raise awareness. I don't think it's the best step, and we really need to look at the complexity of the issue to really get the best solutions for this problem.
Dr. Rich, do you agree how this will affect your compliant patients?
I beg to differ in calling patients good patients or bad patients. Both were mentioned on the show, and it's not that. It's a patient who has opiate addiction or a patient who doesn't.
Barry Meyer, wrap us up here in our last minute. How do you see these FDA recommendations changing how doctors operate and generally how our healthcare system operates when it comes to narcotic painkillers?
I think that the changes will not be that dramatic. I mean, doctors who prescribe these drugs will continue to prescribe them. There will be some fallout for patients. The patients who will be most affected, the ones that Dr. Burrell was talking about, are the long-term chronic pain patients. who may have to be seen more, but then there may be some who have more difficulties getting to doctors. On the flip side, on the abuse side, it's speculative as well. We really don't know what this step will do. That will play itself out in coming years. But, you know, I think what your callers and the experts who are on have pointed to is these are all like piecework, patchwork solutions. This is not – Dr. Burrell says, I don't think it's the best answer. Well, unfortunately, if there was a best answer, people would have gotten there a long time ago. So we're struggling with this. We're struggling with this in bits and pieces. And until we look at pain differently, we probably won't have the best answer.
Thank you very much for your insights today. A terrific panel. Barry Meyer, health policy and business reporter for The New York Times. Barry, thank you very much for your work on this.
My pleasure.
Dr. Josiah Rich, joining me here in the studio, professor of medicine, community health, and epidemiology at Brown University School of Medicine and an expert on addiction. Thank you very much, sir. And Dr. Brian Brewell, assistant professor, Department of Pain Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Dr. Brewell, thank you.
You're welcome.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, 1 year after Hurricane Sandy, we'll look back. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.